It was 50 years ago today that 500,000 people came together for a music festival known as Woodstock. The three-day event in August 1969, which was held on a dairy farm in New York State, was a celebration of peace, love and music, and included some of the most legendary performances in history. Here's a reminder. People try to put us. Woodstock has become synonymous with the counterculture movement of the 1960s and has earned a hallowed place in pop culture history. Steve Waxman is a professor of music and American studies at Smith College in Massachusetts, and he joins me now. Welcome to RM Breakfast.
Thank you, Patricia. It's good to be here.
All right, so give me the sense of history here. Can you remind us how this Woodstock Festival came about?
Well, it came about through a partnership between two kind of counterculture visionaries and two business investors. It was a little bit of an inconvenient marriage, but they came together over the notion that they could really produce something that could be impactful and also, hopefully, as they thought, profitable. It was, in some ways, a culmination of a whole slew of festivals that had happened in the years leading up. Going back to the Newport Jazz Festival, the Newport Folk Festival in the U.S., which had not been quite on the same scale, but by the middle of the 1960s, when Bob Dylan appeared at Newport Folk, for instance, he had like 75,000 people coming out on a weekend. And I think it's no accident that Woodstock programmed so many folk performers, because it was really kind of building on the established idea of the festival that was already there, but it was translating it into a new youth culture where rock and not just folk was the primary musical language that bound people together.
Organizers were expecting, I think it was around 100,000 people to turn up over the three-day event, but it attracted, as you say, like really nearly 500,000 people. Why did exceed the numbers in quite such a, you know, really freakish way? Like, that is not just a, you know, a bit oversubscribed. That is quite something.
Yeah, you know, and on some level, that is one of the big historical mysteries of Woodstock. I mean, I think you can hypothesize it's like generational, you know, common feeling that just became an outpouring of interest in this event. I'm a little bit skeptical of the notion that everyone who came to Woodstock came there with the same motivation. I mean, if you have 400,000 or so people attending something like this, they're not all there for the same reason. But I do think there was this sense that this event was going to, whatever it was going to be, it was going to offer something that was unprecedented. And partly that was a product of the very good publicity that the organizers had put out there. But partly it was about the way that the music and the culture of that era were generating a sense of optimism and hope and a shared sense of possibility that a lot of people wanted to tap into.
There was a lot of sex, there was a lot of drugs, and there was a lot of rain. It was almost actually washed out, but it didn't deter the crowd, did it? I mean, I don't know. I'm at a festival and it rains and I run home, so I'm very impressed by the sort of stamina of these people.
Well, you couldn't run home, keep in mind, right?
I mean,
one of the great parts of the story is like the traffic jam leading up to the festival was so remarkable. Nobody was really coming or going anywhere. So on that score, I think part of what made the festival so unusual was not just the people endured it, but that they found a way to enjoy themselves despite the fact that on a purely logistical level, there was a lot of things that were not working the way they were supposed to. And the rain was just one part of that.
The rain was just a part of it. All right. Well, Jimi Hendrix played the last set with his rendition of the Star Spangled Banner. It went down in pop culture history as his breakout performance. Like, Woodstock really shone the light on a lot of performers and bands who weren't even yet established. Who were some of the headline acts?
Well, some of the headline acts wound up not being the most well-remembered performers like Janis Joplin, for instance, who, you know, her performance was never even included in the original film or album, I think partly for economic considerations and partly because it was not one of her best performances. On the other hand, you've got Sly and the Family Stone, who wind up performing at 2-3 in the morning and energizing the crowd in a way that few people could have. And it, I think that was an especially noteworthy performance because, as his subsequent career would show, Sly Stone was not always the most reliable live performer. He could be completely electrifying or he could be completely out of it. He developed a reputation for not even showing up to a lot of concerts in his later career. And so the fact that we have that Woodstock performance from him and it's preserved and it's on film and it is just as compelling on film and on record as it was at the time, I think really lets us see somebody at the peak of their power. I mean, you mentioned Hendrix. I think the Star Spangled Banner is absolutely one of the signature, his version of the Star Spangled Banner is one of the signature works of the 20th century in terms of an instrumentalist taking a known melody and taking something with great symbolic importance and translating it into some completely different kind of artistic statement that was a commentary on the times politically and culturally. Crosby, Stills, and Nash, of course, played one of their earliest performances there. And while listening to the recordings, you can hear, the harmonies don't always line up exactly the way you'd want. It was still a momentous performance for putting out this new group that was bringing together some of the energy of the folk movement and some of the energy of the rock movement and translating it again into the terms of the new youth audience.
Well, let's settle this. There's been a debate for a long time about whether this was a revolution or not. Half a century on, has Woodstock's symbolism of peace and love been overly romanticized in pop culture, in your view?
Yes. To be blunt, in my view, it has. And that's not to say that the communal spirit of the event was not real and was not felt by a lot of people who were there and a lot of people who've, you know, been touched by it subsequently. But I really do think it's also important to remember that this was a commercial enterprise as well. It was not only done for communitarian purposes. They lost a lot of money when they decided to make it a free concert. But meanwhile, they put so much work into the technical particulars of getting the festival together and the sound production and the stage production and all of the details that went into the planning that worked really set the stage for the rock concert industry to grow into an enormous financial proposition in a way that it had not been previously. And I don't think that's necessarily a bad development, but it's not something I would romanticize.
Let's not romanticize it, but it's so fun romanticizing it. Steve, thanks for coming on the show.
My pleasure. Good to talk to you.
There's nothing like a bit of romanticising and a bit of nostalgia as well. Steve Waxman there, a professor of music and American studies at Smith College in Massachusetts.